This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And during the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. It conducts innovative research and programs in health and nutrition, and it provides consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. In the cover story of the May 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, Director of Nutrition Bonnie Liebman reports about the association between external cues and overeating. Her report presents the results of her interview of Brian Wansink, the John S. Dyson Professor of Marketing in the Cornell University Applied Economics and Management Department. Dr. Wansink also directs the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University. He was the executive director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion from 2007 to 2009, and he is the author of a book entitled Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. If you're like most people, external cues influence how much you eat, which foods you eat, how fast you eat, whether you enjoy what you eat, and more. Brian Wansink of Cornell University has spent a career unearthing those cues. The trick is not just to uncover them, he says, but to change them. Don't say, now that I know it, it won't happen, cautions Dr. Wansink. It will happen. His solution? It is easier to change your environment than it is to change your mind. Dr. Wansink begins the interview by explaining why people overeat. He says that we should be pretty well calibrated to know how much we eat to fill us up. We eat three times a day, every day of our lives. Yet when we asked people, when was the last time you ate to the point of regretting it, almost everyone could think of a time. And then we asked, why did you eat so much? What we found is that roughly 12% said, I overweight because of something emotional, or I had a terrible day, or I was feeling down, or I was bored. About 51% said they overate because they were really hungry. And 37% said that they overate because the food was spectacular. So we asked ourselves, what happens if the person is not hungry and the food is terrible? And that led to our stale popcorn study. We gave people popcorn that was either fresh or 5 days old. The stale popcorn had been kept in a humidity-controlled entomology lab. On a scale of 1 to 10, people rated the taste a 3. It tasted like styrofoam. We gave moviegoers either medium or large bags. And we gave them to people who had eaten dinner within 20 minutes of arriving at the theater. So we gave them bad food when they were not hungry. And people ate 34% more from the bigger bucket. If the popcorn was fresh, they ate 45% more from the larger bags. When people left, we said, "Gee, you ate 34% more. Do you think the size of the bucket has anything to do with it?" And to a person, they said, "No, how could it?" Big servings are not the only influence on how much we eat, however. Very simple things have a tremendous influence, not just on how much, but how frequently we eat. We studied secretaries who had won an award for being great that year. We said, "Congratulations, we're going to give you all the candy you can eat for a month." So we put candies either on their desks or 6 feet from their desks in either a clear or an opaque bowl. And every day we refilled the candy dishes. And we found that a typical secretary on a typical day would eat about 9 Hershey's Kisses, which is about 225 calories, if they were sitting on her desk. But if we moved the candy dish 6 feet away, they ate only 4 candies, or about 125 fewer calories a day. Over the course of a year, that would translate into 11 to 12 pounds of extra weight they would gain by having the candy on the desk instead of 6 feet away. Then we asked the secretaries if 6 feet was just too far to walk, but they said, "No, it's just that the 6 feet gave me pause to think, am I really that hungry?" And half the time, they said no. Seeing the candies also made a difference. Secretaries who got a clear bowl averaged 2 more candies per day than those who got an opaque bowl. Names also influence people. A while back, someone who operated a healthy cafeteria called to say, "No one is eating in our cafeteria. What should we do?" So we simply changed the names of the foods they served. Instead of Italian pasta, we called it succulent Tuscany pasta. Or instead of chocolate cake, we called it Belgian Black Forest cake, even though the Black Forest is not in Belgium. Once we added a descriptive name, sales jumped by 27%. And it's not just that food. People rated the restaurant better and the chef more competent. If you believe that something is going to taste good, you look for the qualities that confirm that. If you believe the milk is spoiled, you drink the milk looking for confirmation of that too. This has great implications for wine. If you buy cheap wine, you think it's going to be terrible. And a person's reaction to one food affects others. We had a big wine and cheese party for my grad students, and we found that if the wine tasted terrible, people rated the cheese served at stations with that wine as terrible also. We wondered if the first thing people try has a poisoning or a halo effect on everything the person tries. We had this restaurant on the University of Illinois campus called the Spice Box. And every Thursday, people would come in and eat a fixed-price dinner. They thought they were actually trying new recipes, but we were actually doing studies on them. One week, we soaked all the labels off the wine bottles and replaced them with labels saying the wine was either from North Dakota or from California. They don't even make wine in North Dakota. It was all the same $2 Cabernet. And we found that if people thought it was from California, they rated the wine as better. And they rated the food as better. They stayed at the restaurant about 10 minutes longer, and many of them made reservations to come back. When we served them the North Dakota wine, it poisoned the entire meal. They did not rate the food as good. They left 10 minutes earlier, and they did not make reservations to come back. That's great news you can use if you have people for dinner parties. I find that if I'm running out of time, I will make sure that the first thing they eat is the best thing I'm cooking, because it has a halo on everything you eat. It is so powerful. Interestingly, both groups drank the same amount of wine, which was all of it. It's free, sure. The power of expectation is immense. We did a study where we gave people a really good brownie on a napkin, a paper plate, or a really nice piece of Wedgwood china. And we asked them what they thought of the brownie. If they ate the brownie on the napkin, they would say, "Wow, this is really good." On a paper plate, they said, "This is really, really good." If they ate it, the brownie off of Wedgwood china, they would say, "This is the greatest brownie I have eaten in my entire life." And the amount they were willing to pay for it tripled. So, when I'm having people over for dinner, if I put the nice china out and put a tablecloth on and candlelight, they will think the dinner is more amazing and that I'm a more amazing cook than if I don't. If we leave the food on the table, do people eat more? Well, guys eat about 29% more if you put the serving dish on the table instead of the counter. And women eat about 10% more if you put the serving dish on the table. The primary reason is that guys eat very fast. They finish a meal and then they impatiently watch while the rest of the family pokes at their food. So guys often have seconds and thirds. Women tend to eat a bit slower and are not as prone to going back for seconds and thirds. We were also able to influence how quickly people ate. We had people eat lunch sitting across from somebody who they believed was also part of a taste testing study. They did not realize that the other person was a researcher who was instructed to eat either 50% more slowly or 50% faster than the typical person would eat. We called it forks per minute. And we found that when someone was paired with someone eating faster, they ended up eating significantly more calories than if they ate alone. And when they were paired with someone eating slower, they ate fewer calories. We did another study where we brought in people for this free buffet lunch. We found that if a woman was following another woman, the woman behind took, on the average, a portion that mimicked, though not exactly, the serving taken by the woman in front. Now, if a woman was following a man, the person in front mattered less. How can you benchmark off a 250-pound man who's wearing a baseball cap backwards? For guys, the person in front had no impact. Guys just fill their plate. And it doesn't matter what the woman in front looks like. We put the person ahead of the woman in line in a fat suit, so she looked obese. You might think, gee, if you follow someone who's really heavy and they take a lot of food, you're probably going to take less because you'll see the consequences of eating too much. No. If the person ahead in line is really heavy, the follower takes more. People seem to think, well, I'm not that heavy, so I can afford to take a lot of food. The same thing happens if the server is in a fat suit. We also varied the attractiveness of the server. But that had no effect. As far as people determining when they're full goes, most people say, okay, all these little things around me might influence me a little bit, but I know when I'm full, and I know when to stop. So we asked ourselves, what happens if your plate never empties? Would you eat like the family dog until you threw up? So we brought in these refillable bowls. People could not see that the bowls refilled as they ate. And those who unknowingly ate out of the refillable soup bowl ate 73% more soup than others. When we asked them if they were full, they did not rate themselves as more full than the other group. They would say, how can I be full? I have half a bowl of soup left. They relied on external cues. The idea is that you count with your eyes, not your stomach. We did a similar study in Atlanta. We brought people into an all-you-can-eat buffalo wings restaurant. We randomly assigned them to tables where the bones left from the eaten wings were either bust or just kept building up on the table, so you could see how much you had taken. We found that if the wings were taken away, people ate around 28% more. When the bones were gone, there was no visual evidence they were there to begin with. So people kept eating. And on the way out of the restaurant, we offered them all the chance to test a free 450-calorie skillet cookie. Only 15% of the people who had seen how many bones they had eaten took the huge cookie. The other group not only ate more wings, but about 85% of them took the cookie. And two-thirds of them started eating it before they even got into their car. So some foods have what is called a health halo. We did four studies with dramatic results. It started with our Subway study. You see commercials with Jared saying, "Look how much weight I lost. I go to Subway pretty regularly, and I'd see people asking for a double cheese and mayo and other stuff. When I'd ask why they eat at Subway, they'd say, 'I watch what I eat, and it's a healthy place to eat.'" That led us to wonder who overeats more, someone who eats at a Subway or someone who eats at a burger place like McDonald's. Especially if you define overeating as eating more calories than you think. So we did a number of studies. One involved intercepting people who just finished dinner at a McDonald's or a Subway at a mall. And we found that the typical person leaving McDonald's was eating about 1,090 calories, but they thought they had eaten about 880 calories, which is not a bad guess. In contrast, people leaving Subway believed they were eating about 495 calories, and they were averaging about 680. So the McDonald's eaters underestimated their calories by 19%, but the Subway eaters underestimated their calories by 27% because of Subway's health halo. They underestimated the calories in the sandwich. They didn't count the extra cheese or mayonnaise, and it led them to think that the chips are healthier. The Subway eaters thought they were being virtuous, and they were not. A health halo permeates a lot of our food decisions. I just had a dissertation defense for a student who found that if people were given a food labeled organic, they estimated the calories as 15 to 20% lower than if the food was not called organic. In another study, we gave people an Italian sandwich and a menu showing that it was either from Jim's Hardy Sandwich Shop or Good Karma Healthy Foods. If they thought the sandwich was from Good Karma, they estimated the calories as 24% lower than if they thought it was from Jim's. If they thought the sandwich was from Good Karma, they were much more likely to order potato chips, a full-calorie soda, and a cookie with the meal. And the sandwich itself had 660 calories. So, there are real dangers to the health halo. It's not just that you underestimate calories. It's that next step is to reward yourself by eating even more. Foods that are labeled low-fat also have a halo. But if the label says that a food is low-calorie, it has so few calories that you really can eat more. We also found that exercise can have an opposite impact on what we eat than what we might expect. In one study, we showed people normal ads for washers and dryers and such before a meal, or we showed them exercise ads. If people saw the exercise ads and they were reasonably active exercisers, the ads dramatically decreased how much they ate. We think the ads bring to mind how much you have to do to work off a certain amount of calories. So it's a pretty dramatic reminder. The ads have much less impact if people are not exercisers. So if you're a pretty good exerciser, it might be a pretty good idea before dinner to think about your next workout. And the exercise itself matters. Every June, we have consumer camp for anyone from anywhere in the country who has been involved in one of our studies. And at one of these camps, we said, "We're through for the day, but dinner is not ready yet, so we're going to take a 1 mile walk." The students who set the pace told them that it was either an exercise walk or a scenic walk. On the exercise walk, the students would say, "We're a quarter of a way through," or "We're halfway through. Keep your heartbeat going. Keep it high." On the scenic walk, the students would say, "Oh, here's the stone bridge that was built in 1922. Or look, there's an island and three kinds of birds live on that island." And it was an easy walk, but the same pace and distance in both cases. When they got back, they were given dinner, and they ended up eating more calories if they had been on the exercise walk. And most of that increase was from dessert. The exercise group estimated that they had burned more calories, so they ended up eating more calories. It seems that people always find rationale to eat more, and intelligent people especially can figure out a rationalization for anything they want to believe, We call it the intelligence trap. This whole idea that you can prevent mindless eating with the power of your mind is a tremendous fallacy. When I talk about mindless eating, some people erroneously say, then the secret to solving a mindless eating is to eat mindfully. No, not if you are 95% of the population. To eat half of a pea and ask, am I full yet, may work for some people. And I know calorie counting and pre-portioning works for some people. But for most Americans, our lives are way too chaotic to accommodate that. We have screaming kids running around the table, a to-do list before dinner that's 40 things long, and we're thinking about things, how things went at work that day, and how they didn't go how we wanted them to. So for normal people, the solution is not mindful eating. It is to set up our environment, whether at our home or at work, so that we mindlessly eat less, rather than just continue to gorge ourselves. The good news is that for every external cue that messes people up in our studies, you can solve the problem by doing the opposite. So, what changes should we make? Use smaller bowls or plates. Make sure that the first thing you see, the thing that's front and center, is healthier than the other items in the room. Package things in smaller containers. Then you'll eat only the amount that you put in. And regarding school lunches, the New York State Department of Health found that fruit is more likely to be eaten if it is served in colorful, attractive containers and it is visible. With adults, we find that covering the clear window of the ice cream freezer with butcher paper decreases how much people take by 30%. And you can do the same thing at home. Why not make the fruit bowl more visible? Put your fruit on the table and not in the refrigerator bin. People say that's okay because I have self-control. But why not give your self-control a break? We have reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. And the show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, July 6. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I do hope you've enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience, and it is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. See you next month.